Accession number 19910, Reel 2.
Annie Bambridge, Reel 2.
From Takoradi, we flew across Africa in a Dakota to Cairo at Heliopolis, and we spent some time hanging about there waiting posting from there. During that period, we went to Alexandria and an airfield near there out in the desert for a refresher course, because by then we had done no flying for some time, and we had a short refresher flight in that area. But then another posting came up from the Middle East to India Command, and we were sent by boat down through the Red Sea via Aden to Bombay in India. And I was posted to 60 Squadron in India, which is where I did most of my actual war service. But looking back through my dates in my logbook, it seems to have taken an awful long time to get from signing on and starting training before I actually joined an operational squadron.
So you were actually in North Africa in the Middle East from February 43 to April 43. Any incidents that happened to you whilst you were there?
No, not really. That was a hanging about sort of period. When you say April 43, that's after the sea voyage as well, isn't it? I think to India. But it was mostly hanging about, waiting, posting.
And what about the voyage to India from the Middle East? Did that go smoothly?
Yes, that was smoothly. We were still a Blenheim crew by then. I still had an observer and a wireless operator with me, and we had all been together since we trained at Bicester.
Can you tell me who the members of the crew were?
The gunner, the gunner was Maurice Finningley, a Manchester lad who came from Failsworth, as I recall. And the observer was Norman Hayworth. And as I say, we stayed together then until we joined the squadron on Blenheims. But that squadron at that time had been drawn back from operations and was resting. At Bangalore, in the middle of India. And after a short time, it was decided that Blenheims were no use in India, and they decided to convert the squadron to a Hurricane, Harry Bomber Squadron, doing close army support. So at this point, the observers and rear gunners were moved away from us, and Morris and Norman went to join 31 Squadron, flying Dakotas on army support and supply dropping. I went down from Bangalore to Madras, where we did some flying training and conversion. Oh no, the conversion was done at Bangalore from twin engine aircraft to learn to fly Hurricanes. And we flew Hurricanes there and then went down to Madras for further fighter training on Hurricanes.
How did you find the difference between flying a Harry Bomber from
Blenheim? I don't recall there were any real problems. Obviously, they only had one engine. And I was completely on my own. There was no sort of crew with me to talk to. But I quite enjoyed it. I've recently been asked what it was like when I first soloed in a Hurricane. But to be perfectly honest, I can't remember a thing about it. They must have just said, well, do this, do that. And I did it. But there couldn't have been any real serious incidents, because I can't remember any vital thing about that part of the training. Just happened.
What about the population of India, the civilians in India? How were you getting on with those?
Well, we didn't have a lot to do with them. We got on with them all right. On an airfield, you're more or less a unit on your own. You don't sort of get around a great deal. We sort of went out in the evenings to local hotels and things like that, but we met no real problems vis-a-vis the local population, except for one incident when there was supposed to have been trouble one evening, and the squadron was paraded to sort of identify troublemakers, but nobody was identified and nothing more came of it. So I don't really know. I've no idea what really happened. It just, I was vaguely conscious that there was a problem somewhere, but sorry, I can't tell you any more about that than that.
Was the trouble being caused by RAF or by Indians?
I don't know. I honestly don't know. It's I do know the station commander threatened that if he was made to hold an identity parade, he would make sure he paraded the wrong squadron, but I can't vouch for that. That's mere rumour.
Did you ever come across any hostility from Indians?
No, I didn't, personally.
Did you ever see any signs of civil disturbance? Though?
No. There was a period later on, much later on, when there were possibilities of riots at that time. And we got to the stage of being, I was commissioned by then, and we got to the stage of being told how to read the Riot Act if it was necessary to do so. But it never became necessary to do so. I later read of reports of RAF rebellions and mutinies and all that sort of thing, but I've no evidence of that at all, and I don't know where those stories came from.
Where was it that you were told how to read the Riot Act?
Oh, that was much later on. We got back to Bhopal by then. Marbleshwar. Not Marbleshwar, in Bhopal. So that would be about 44, early 45.
According to your record, it was May 45 you were in Bhopal.
Oh, that would be the time.
But at the moment, you're in Madras in the summer of 1943, converting to
hurricanes. To hurricanes, that's right. Learning a fighter role as well as a bombing role.
What did that involve, learning a fighter role?
Well, air-to-ground firing with fixed guns and fighter tactics generally.
What kind of weaponry was the Hurry Bomber equipped
with?
Well,
the one we had was a 2C, which was equipped with 4 20mm cannon in the wings instead of the 8 machine guns.
Were there any problems with the weaponry?
No. Always seemed to function quite well when it was required. We carried long-range tanks as well, long-range fuel tanks. Either long-range fuel tanks or 250-pound bombs under the wings. And that was the weaponry we carried.
How did you like it in Madras?
Oh, I liked Madras. It was a nice town. I enjoyed it. There was some flooding while we were there, but that's the usual thing in Madras, I believe, about the monsoon time.
What did you like about Madras?
Oh, I don't know. There's sort of general feeling of the place itself. It was a nice area. Sort of nice.
And you were at St. Thomas's Mount?
St. Thomas Mount, and there was another, was it Shalavram, nearby? There was a secondary airfield somewhere that we went to. We used to do formation flying around there and fighter tactics generally, air-to-ground firing, that sort of thing.
What kind of facilities did you have in the airfields in Madras area?
Facilities, I don't really recall. What exactly are you thinking of? What sort of?
How much provision was there made for the airmen?
For the airmen? Well, as far as I can recall, they were simply the sort of bashers of the type that were used in that area. They wouldn't be sort of solid stone buildings as far as I can recall, but I'm afraid my memories of that time are very vague nowadays. Little things, silly things stay in one's mind, but other items just disappear from memory.
What type of things have stirred in your mind?
Oh, you're putting me on it now, aren't you? I don't know. I really couldn't say that sort of...
So after Madras, what happened then?
I'm trying to remember. We went from Madras to Agartala, I think it was, where we really started operating. We were based on the same airfield as the Dakota squadron that my crew had joined. That was 31 squadron. And they were flying supplies to the army. And occasionally they would be attacked by fighters. And if that happened, we were ordered the next day to escort them. And we provided fighter cover for the supply drop, which was usually around the Tidim area, just south of Imphal. And at that time, that was about where the fighting had got to, as the Japanese tried to invade India. But it always struck me as rather strange that nothing seemed to happen when we were escorting. We didn't even see any aircraft, and it felt like a bit of a damp squib to me. We sort of circled around and had a front seat of the supply dropping, but as far as enemy aircraft went, we didn't see a thing. So I must admit, at that time, I felt a bit of a fraud as a fighter pilot. But there you are, that's the way the war was going. From Agartala, we did various different sorts of operations. At that time, the army was surrounded down in the Arakan, in what was known as the box. And we used to go down from Agartala to more forward strips in the Arakan to do individual sorties when called upon from those areas. That would be in support of the army attacking Japanese points, usually right over the top of our own troops, in close army support. There was also an operation known as a night rhubarb, which I was sent on only once. And the idea was that we went down to Chittagong and we operated from there, being called upon if any activity was seen on the rivers nearby to go and shoot up barges or whatever were on the river. I did one operation like that, but was fortunately not called upon to go because nothing was sighted that particular night. So again, nothing really happened. I sort of went down to Chittagong, slept overnight waiting for a call, and then flew back to Agartala the next day. And that was the end of that. Again, it seems very minor and unexciting. Perhaps I should be thankful.
How would your aircraft have fared if you had run into a Zero or some such enemy aircraft?
Do you mean would they have been a match for it? Oh, I think so. The Hurricane was a very proud of the Hurricane. It was quite a good, solid aircraft to fly, I think. And I think we would have come off all right. But unfortunately, or perhaps fortunately, I was never put to the test, I'm afraid. In fact, at one time, we were scrambled from Agartala and vectored in the wrong direction and never even made contact with the enemy. So the ground crews rather scathingly referred to our Hurricanes as flying air raid shelters. But
And what successes did you have against enemy shipping, if any?
We didn't actually see any shipping because we were. if we'd gone out on a night rhubarb, it would have been against sort of river craft and that sort of thing, not against actual shipping. We didn't attack shipping at all.
What success did you have against river craft?
Well, I didn't come across any anyway. So I think it's a mere harassment actually for the enemy as much as anything.
And then what do you remember?
Well, as I say, there was the escorting of supply dropping. There was the close army support later, which became a little bit more exciting when we had an army liaison officer attached to the unit, and calls would come from the army for supporting strikes against points, Japanese resistance. And we would almost be like the artillery. We would soften up the enemy for our own attack to go in. But there were several come and go engagements like that where we would attack a point one day, that would be captured, and a few days later we'd be back to the same point because it had been recaptured. So there was a lot of to-ing and fro-ing at that time. And by then we'd moved up from Agatala. When the Japanese got surrounding Imphal, we were moved up from Agatala to Kumbagram, and operated from Kumbagram, usually on a day-to-day basis, flying from Kumbagram into the Imphal Valley to a strip in Palau at the south of the valley. We would operate from there during the day, like a day excursion, and then return to Kumbagram at night. But the airfield we were operating from was almost surrounded by Japanese anyway. So I was always quite relieved when my aircraft functioned in the evening to get back to Kumbagram and have a safe night's rest. But that was the way it was operating at that time. And from Kumbagram we moved up to Silchar, which is near Jorhat, up to the north. And by that time the war had moved around to Kohima. And there was some pretty bloody fighting going on around the Kohima area, and we were called upon to do quite a few support strikes in that region. And that is when we really began to sort of hot up and have a lot of operations. There would be two or three a day, often to the same, back and forth to the same battle area. This was the time when gliders were towed into Broadway and the other landing strips behind the enemy lines, but we weren't involved in that. But they were operating from the American base at Jorhat nearby, so we saw something of them at that time. But most of our work was carried on down through around Kohima and around that area. When the Kohima Road was opened eventually and we were able to get through to Imphal by road, the squadron moved down to Kangla, which is an airfield in the north of the Imphal Valley. And we carried on doing the same sort of operations from there. But by then the Japanese were being pushed back a bit. We carried on flying throughout the monsoon anyway, and the Japanese were being pushed back from surrounding the valley, back down the Tamu Road into the Kabul Valley, further into Burma.
When you were on these bombing and strafing attacks, would you ever see the enemy or people?
You didn't see a lot of them, actually. Their camouflage and hiding was pretty good. In fact, one of the most remarkable things we always felt was that if you were flying down into the Kabul Valley, you could almost see where our troops were and the enemy were, because the dust from our vehicles would line the road and the trees, whereas the enemy seemed to be able to keep it clear. There'd be a marked difference in the area, to our mind, as to what was happening. I don't know how they did it, but they seemed to sort of cover their tracks pretty well indeed, whereas our fellas weren't so good. But then we were by that time moving forward pretty quickly, so it didn't really matter very much.
Is that because they had more to fear from the air?
Well, I think they did in a way, because talking to some of them years and years later, they were very envious of the air support which our soldiers received. Our army received far more air support from the RAF than they did from the Japanese Air Force, particularly in the way of supply dropping.
How frightening was it for you conducting these strafing and bombing attacks?
It must have been frightening at the time, but you know, it's you're not very old, and it's sort of all a bit of fun at the time as well. So the fright doesn't last, fortunately. Obviously, you do think about these things. Must have thought about these things at the time, but you're too busy doing the work. And we usually went in to strafe and bomb in pairs. And you'd perhaps call out something over the RTA as you went into your number two, and you'd both just go in. The bombs we dropped usually had delays on them, so you had to sort of about 11-second delay, so that you could get in, almost dive bomb with them, and then pull out and get away before your bomb exploded, obviously. So you had to make sure you didn't go too far behind your number two, or he wasn't too far behind you.
How was the work of the pair of aircraft coordinated on an attack?
Just by RT. Not from base, but I mean just between ourselves. Sort of, you would just go on the RT and sort of point out where you thought we ought to attack. We'd been briefed beforehand, so we knew roughly where we were going.
But presumably each pilot didn't decide off his own bat what he was going to do.
Oh no, it'd be a squadron effort. We'd decide what, over the RT, the leader of that operation would tell you where we were attacking, and you'd follow each other in, try and identify the target and follow in from that.
You mean one pilot would go in?
Yeah.
And then the other one would go in on the same
part? On the same part, yeah.
You didn't go in different courses?
No.
Why not?
Not necessarily. I mean, you just pick on the target and go from wherever you happen to be. It was a bit of a melee, obviously, for that time. You can't sort of pin down second by second what happened. But I was unfortunate enough to lose one, number two, over the Tamu Road from gunfire. We were attacking a gunpoint, and my number two was a Australian warrant officer. And flying onto the target and strafing and bombing, as we pulled away, he must have been hit because he bailed out and landed successfully. Unfortunately, in trying to make his way back to base, he came across a Gurkha patrol who mistook him for a Japanese, and he was shot and buried more or less there. So that's lingered in my mind ever since. He was number two to me, and he was hit, I wasn't. But,
what was he hit by?
I could probably ACAC light flak from the ground, I should think.
Was that machine gun?
I would think so. I mean, that's pure conjecture.
Did you ever?
He obviously had problems, and we never knew why he bailed out. He made no message or no RT call or anything like that. He just suddenly disappeared.
Did you ever get holes in your own aircraft?
No, I don't think I think I emerged unscathed. I must have been very lucky, I think.
Did you take things with you in case you were hit?
In the way of escape maps or something like that, you mean?
Water, provisions?
Oh yes, you'd have a water bottle and a cookery and a 0.38 revolver, but I've never had to use it, so what would have happened if I had? I can't imagine. But I carried a cookery on my belt, the Gurkha cookery.
Medical kit?
Well, you'd have the field dressing, that's all. Not, nothing very elaborate.
Did you have
And you'd have some what we call K rations at that time. They were American sort of designed packs to sustain you if you were on your own in the jungle. They'd have a bar of chocolate perhaps, or some food, or Horlicks tablets or something like that to sort of keep you going.
And would you have maps and compasses and so on?
You'd have that as well, yeah.
Did you fear very much falling into the hands of the Japanese?
Well, yes, of course. I mean, the thought was always there. As I say, when we operated during the day from a Japanese surrounded base, I was always glad to get out of it. The idea of falling into their hands wasn't very alluring.
Any other specific incidents you remember as on the ground attacks, please?
No, there was quite close support with the army, and it was always very satisfying to get a signal from the army sometimes to say, well, thanks for your help, you know, you did well, or we were pleased. And sometimes we operated so near to our own airstrip that when one flight took off, you could see from where you were, you could see their attack being carried out in the other corner of the valley. It was as close as that. So that the operational sorties we did were a matter of a few minutes or half an hour or so.
I see in one place in your logbook you've written strawberry received from the army. What does that mean?
Well, that's the opposite of a raspberry. As you know, it's a sort of a... It was a thank you, a good wishes, rather than saying, what do you think you're doing? A sort of, as I say, the opposite of a raspberry, you can imagine.
How did weather conditions affect you in this area?
Well, of course, the monsoon... I think, to some extent, operating through the monsoon was the turning point of the war at that time, because there had been an earlier period in the war in Burma and India where the monsoon weather was so bad that everybody more or less stopped doing very much until that was over. But then when the Japanese got as far as surrounding Imphal and Kohima, it was decided that we would carry on regardless of the monsoon and just fly whenever we could. That sometimes necessitated landing on a strip which was pretty waterlogged, and at Dogon in particular, they had a kind of metal strip on the ground, and landing in that after a heavy monsoon rain was like landing on the sea. The water sort of just surged up all around the aircraft as you landed. So we managed to keep going anyway during that period. And as I say, I think that was rather the turning point of things, because we did keep fighting on during that time. What it was like on the ground, I shudder to think. But
did you know very much about the particular army units you were supporting and what they were doing at that time?
Not really, no. I don't recall. I think we were more or less briefed by the army liaison officer every morning and shown where the battle line was at that time, as far as it could be marked. Unfortunately, of course, at that sort of time, it moves pretty rapidly. And certainly in the early days of the Japanese invasion of Imphal, there were occasions when the supplies were dropped and the troops had moved out before the supplies got...